Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with two of the renowned researchers for the UFO crash at Roswell, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. And guys, you have a new book called Witness to Roswell. Tell me a little bit about that real quick. If you're still there. Hello?
Hello, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Actually, it's the revised edition. The first edition came out in 2007, and it was the number one best-selling UFO book in the world for 2007 and 2008.
Where can people go to get a copy of it?
Certainly Barnes & Noble, and certainly online, Amazon.com.
And your website is RoswellInvestigator.com,
correct.
Great. Well, we're talking a little bit about this Max Brazel, the guy who, the ranch that this thing happened on.
Right.
And we're going to play a clip from Bill Brazel, his son. And yes, he's also going to talk about, and this is something I haven't heard him saying in person, that he was also intimidated. And this notion that there was this mafia-style method of shutting people up is, I think, is a new feature. We're going to play that right after the break. Don't go away. We're back talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. And this next clip is Bill Brazel. He's just sort of telling the tale that happened to his father in his own words. You want anything, any comments on this, guys?
Well, Bill Brazel, we often refer to him as Bill Jr., but it wasn't Bill Jr., just Bill Brazel. Real nice guy. Don knew him better than I did. And he was the one who showed us, I believe, the first time we went out to the crash site, or at least at the debris field, he was the one that showed us where it actually was. And I know whenever we would visit him in his Corona ranch, he would always get very emotional about the event. And we've run into this so often that the people speaking to us get very emotional, and when you don't actually meet the participants, it's easy to say this or that about them, but until you meet them and talk to them and get their stories and see their lives, it's quite compelling.
Okay, let's meet Bill and hear what he has to say in his own words.
According to my dad, there was a bad thunderstorm the night before. The next day, he was out on the ranch, and he found this debris. And he picked it all up in his pickup and was talking to people. And, of course, there was some talk about UFOs. He was going to Roswell, and as far as I know, he got in touch with the sheriff's department. They, in turn, called the Air Force. Then the Air Force got with Dad and swore him to secrecy, and they came out to the ranch and picked up this debris. Wood, I call it wood. I don't know what it was. It was something like balsa wood, but it wouldn't burn. And I couldn't cut it with my knife.
Yeah, very direct statement there.
And his own wife, Shirley, was a witness to the material as well, because Bill would, especially after heavy rainstorms, he would go out and find additional artifacts, you know, months after the military cleanup. And he found enough pieces to fill up a cigar box. And his wife Shirley would even describe to us how there was one particular piece that he'd keep in his leather chaps. And he'd sit down to dinner in the evening, and he'd always take this one piece out, and she'd just fascinated by watching how, no matter what he would do with his pocket knife or his lighter, or how he would try to cut on it or scrape on it. And then she'd watch as he would crumble and crease and fold and wad it up into a ball. No matter what he did to it, he would lay it down onto the table, and it would always just smooth right out.
Yeah.
Right before her eyes.
Yeah, it's the same type of thing we hear from a lot of different witnesses. Well, let's hear about this material and how it got Bill in a bit of trouble.
He said that's what the Air Force tried to make him believe, that it was a weather balloon. And he said, Bill, he said, it was not a weather balloon. He said, I don't know what it was. But he said it was something altogether different and much bigger. And I was talking about it. I went into Corona and I was sitting there in a beer joint, and I up to this. Of course, my friends is asking me if I'd found any more or anything like this. And I said, well, I picked up a few scraps, about a cigar box full. And somebody, I don't know, must have informed the Air Force, because first thing I know, I have visitors. And they say they'd like to have this material. And they didn't tell me they'd confiscate it. They just said, well, like, we're going to have it one way or the other, you know.
And I'm sure that they did.
Now, the amazing thing that we need to emphasize here is that for anyone still suggesting that this was, again, some top secret project, you know, manufactured here or in Germany or in Russia or anywhere else for that matter, we're still talking about conventional materials. We're still talking about metals. We're talking about rivets, wiring, vacuum tubes, that type of thing. That it may be the project, it may be knowledge of the project that would be top secret, not the materials. This clearly demonstrates that they were specifically keen and very persistent on recovering every last piece of physical evidence. It was the physical material. And in the case of Bill Brazel, when his material was retrieved, it was 2 years after the incident. So in other words, they were still monitoring not only the Brazel family, but anyone else they suspected who still may have had pieces of the physical evidence in their possession. That, again, I mean, rules out anything conventional. It was the material and people who actually had the physical proof that could have essentially, you know, blown this out of the water.
Well, you've been out there and you've dug up some of that soil around there. What was your experience?
Well, you're talking about the digs?
Yeah, the digs, the Roswell digs.
Yeah. First of all, it's a forlorn place. I mean, out in the middle of nowhere, it's a sheep pasture. And this was in 2002. We enlisted with the help of the Sci-Fi Channel, who funded it, we enlisted the University of New Mexico to oversee the dig, to actually be the ones in charge of laying out the grid, et cetera, et cetera. And the hope was that we would find some animal burrows, like, you know, rodents. They tend to take things into their nest underground. And the hope was that we would, you know, find a couple of those where that they might have carried some of the material into their nest. But the area of the sheep pasture was not deep enough to where animals actually burrowed. So we conducted a regular dig, set out the grid, dug pits. But the problem was that we only covered less than 10% of the crash site. 90% went untouched. And at least in my opinion, and I think Don will back me up on this, our chances of actually finding a piece of the debris was not in the area where we dug. The area where we dug was sort of the where the gouge was. We did find evidence of a gouge. I will say that. We believe we found evidence of a gouge, but we did not find any material because, at least in my mind, we did not dig in the right place. A new dig that we're planning, we expect to dig in some of the outerlying areas where the wind blew things that the military did not pick up. That that's what we're hoping for. Yes, it's a needle in a haystack, but it's work that has to be done, and we intend to do it. So we were gratified that we could do the dig, but I think we were disappointed in the outcome, in that we dug in the wrong place.
And when Tom says the wrong place, he's defining the specific location as ground zero. This was the principal area of debris, and it would have been the area that they would have focused on primarily in cleaning it up, and as witnesses have described, even using industrial vacuum cleaners, even sucking up as much of the topsoil as they could in the process of their recovery operation. We did the first dig back in September of 1989, and it was after, as Tom had mentioned before, Bill Brazzo himself had driven us to the very location, showed us where the gouge, the furrow, was present after the cleanup, suggesting an impact, something had skipped across the ground. And he also showed us specifically where he had found the pieces just mentioned in his little snippet about filling up a cigar box. We've had additional firsthand witnesses, hired hands who work with Mac Brazzo, such as Tommy Tyree, neighbors, Bud Payne, Robert Wolf, L.D. Sparks, all describing the exact same location. The last dig we performed was in 2006, and at that time, we even hired people, scientists, to come in with subterranean radar equipment, ground-penetrating equipment. But again, they only covered a very small area.
Also, Don, the area turned out to be a drainage area. Substrate was not deep at all. It was very thin. The ground-penetrating radar really did not have a chance to work its magic, because it was a drainage area, and everything just got all, constantly eroded away.
Yeah, it's not an exact science.
We need to remind people, too, that Brazzo himself, one of the complaints he made, even to the sheriff, George Wilcox, was that he had to circle the sheep 2 miles around the debris field.
Really?
Just to get to the main water trough. They called it pump site number one. And Major Jesse Marcel, the head of intelligence of the 509, when they first arrived at the scene, led to the site by Mac Brazzo, he described how they could not get over the amount of debris. It just covered such a large area. In fact, they described it as covering an area of almost 3/4 of a mile long.
Wow, that's bigger than most descriptions. Well, aside from the wreckage, there were bodies. Let's go back to the audio clips, because we have someone talking about the bodies themselves that were also at this crash site. Beverly Bean, the daughter of one of the fellows who saw the bodies, he was in K-Squad. Tell us a little bit about this before we hear it.
Well, her father was Melvin E. Brown. And when we say a member of K-Squad, he was a member of the kitchen staff. But nonetheless, all personnel at the Roswell Army Airfield, because it was the first atomic base in the world, they were in charge of the atomic bomb, they all had top security clearances. And whenever they relied on base personnel, they pulled them specifically from individual units. They didn't assign entire units for the simple concern that you send a whole squadron of MPs out there, you got a whole barracks that evening exchanging notes. The buzz, is going to become overwhelming at a certain point, reach a crescendo that they're just not going to be able to contain it any longer. But when you piecemeal, you pull out one from this squad, one from this unit, you have no one to talk to when you get back to the base, that evening.
Yeah, interesting. And they were trying to keep it secret even in the method that they were trying to cover it up.
Precisely. And they brought in probably more outside personnel than they even utilized Roswell people. There were MPs, special MPs that came in from White Sands and from Colorado, counterintelligence officers that came in from Carswell in Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay, let's listen to Beverly in her own words.
It's almost as if when he'd actually told the story, he wished he hadn't. All available men were grabbed. So that his actual words, I'm saying here now that I can remember. All available men were grabbed. They all had to go out to the desert where a crash saucer had come down. And they all had to stand guard around this site. They were told to look, but not look, not to take anything in. He lifted up, him and this other guy both lifted up the cover and saw, I say two bodies, but my sister remembers him as saying three. We disagree on that. They saw these bodies, and they were about 4 foot tall, no more than that, maybe even less. Much larger heads than we have. Slanted eyes, yellowish skin.
There you go, another tale from someone who knows one of the witnesses.
Yes, when that recording was made, that was pretty much one of the first eyewitness accounts of the bodies. But since then, we've gotten a number of others that and they match. And we've even gotten another. Melvin Brown, as Don said, was in K Company, the kitchen. He was a cook. And as I have interviewed others, Melvin Brown, it turns out, was really trusted by a lot of the officers on the base. Don't ask me how in what way he was trusted, but that was the word that I got, that the reason that he was chosen for this particular detail was that he was trusted. And those are the types of people that they tried to enlist in this particular event. If they knew somebody could be trusted, they would enlist them. So, and as Don said, many were brought in from elsewhere. And because if you compare notes, pretty soon everybody's talking about it. So if you don't know someone and then you're, sent off to parts unknown and scattered about, then you can't get together and compare notes. And that's what they did here. So, but since the Melvin Brown story broke, and I think that's probably in the early 90s. Is that right, Don?
That's correct. And in fact, he was also our first deathbed testimony.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we went back, and not only was his daughter, Beverly, but also her sister, but then Brown's widow was also interviewed. And they were more reluctant. They didn't want to talk about this. But I went back and I rewatched that entire interview, which was done just outside of London, because that's where the Brown family, Brown was transferred over to England, where the European base of operation of the 509th Bomb Group was actually headquartered. Personnel from Roswell, even the base commander, Colonel Blanchard, they were going back and forth between New Mexico and England at that time. So Brown, he stayed over there after leaving the military, and he married, and he lived out the rest of his life over there. Well, anyway, going back and listening to his wife, and she's describing his final days in the mid-1980s before he passed away at the hospital. And she starts to become very emotional, and she describes how he called her close, and he made the statement, "I want you to know that I have always been faithful to you. I want you to know this." And then he goes on to describe what happened at Roswell. So the point there is, he is equating that, in other words, he is placing that at the same level as of importance.
Real drama in one of America's most dramatic events, and you're hearing it firsthand. We got more clips coming up. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone. We are going through an incredible living testimony of one of the most significant events in American history, the Roswell crash. And we'll have some more audio clips to play in just a moment. I want to ask them, too, when we come back, about their thoughts on the recent FBI memo about the saucer that crashed in New Mexico. I want to get their take on that and much more. Don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. We're back with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. And what about this new FBI memo?
Is this the one it came out several months ago? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Rob, until you just mentioned it, I had forgotten about that. My take on that was that it was the agent was just repeating hearsay. If I recall, there was nothing definitive or corroborated in that particular memo. I believe he was just reporting something he heard in the field, passing it along, and that's what I took it to be.
Give people a little idea of the content.
Well, you're talking Guy Hotel, who supposedly prepared this internal memo as far as for the then director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, in 1950. Now, when we say new FBI document, it's only new in the sense that the FBI on their own website, the FBI Vault, has a section on UFOs. And this document happens to be there. Well, the actual document was retrieved by Dr. Bruce McAbee, I think around 1983, when he, through Freedom of Information, received a whole dossier of declassified UFO documents. So much for the FBI never investigating UFOs. But we had, even 15 years ago, reproduced the document, and we considered it disinformation, that it talks specifically about 50-foot diameter crashes, three of them in New Mexico. It refers to the occupants being with, within diving suits, that type of thing. But the point is, none of the details come close to any of the eyewitness testimony we've heard.
And speaking of eyewitness testimony, we next have Robert Slusher up, who was part of the 393 bomber squadron. Tell us about him.
Bob Slusher was in the 393rd. He was an NCO, non-commissioned officer, and he was very well respected by not only his fellow airmen, but by the officers as well. And he was also an athlete. He played baseball, football, and basketball, and he was one of the longest surviving participants in the event. He passing away, I think it was last year. And he came forward, I believe, in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Don and Kevin had given a talk at the Civic Center there, and he came up afterwards. And he was on the flight that flew the second set of bodies from Roswell. These would be, as we, Don and I, refer to them as the smelly bodies. These are the bodies that Glenn Dennis referred to in his story about being at the hospital and with the nurse who told him to get out of there quick, and everybody was getting sick because of the smell. Bob Slusher was on that B-29, the straight flush, that flew from Roswell on July 9, 1947, to Fort Worth with this large crate that certainly the officers knew, but the airmen, the enlisted men, suspected that it had something to do with the events of what was going on the base at the time.
Okay, let's take a listen. It's Robert Slusher.
It was July 9, 1947, and we left Roswell with a crate, and we flew it to Fort Worth, Coswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth.
What were you told was in the crate?
Actually, when we left, we didn't know. We didn't know that in the crate that there was probably something classified, really, till we got back, and the kind of the rumors started talking around, we did get a little flack as far as that we had taken something probably, and they were joking. joking about it to us, you know, but on the way back, we realized it was something classified, you know, and that they didn't want us to talk about.
I have a feeling that if you got a chance to interview all of these guys that were flying this debris and these bodies around, you pretty much get the same story. Or did you find that when you interviewed people, nothing connected as well as you thought it would?
You know, the wonderful thing about the July 9th straight flush flight over to Fort Worth is that for all of the people we've talked to, minus one, and a couple who just reluctantly denied any knowledge, any memory of the incident, whether it was Lloyd Thompson, whether it was Arthur Ossetroop, whether it was Robert Slusher, who you just heard, they all describe the unusual circumstances of the flight, the heavy guard around the bomb pit where they would normally actually house an A-bomb, and instead was this large rectangular wooden crate loaded into the bomb bay, flying at low altitude because the bomb bay was not pressurized as the guards accompanied the crate, and then arriving at Fort Worth, one of the bombardiers, Lieutenant Felix Martucci, recognized, waiting with the officers on the tarmac for this special cargo, a mortician he had gone to school with years before. And he would deboard and then actually accompany this old friend. They would go into a building and, privately talk. The others were fed. And then on the return flight, they were essentially told, keep their mouths shut. They were not to even utter a word about the flight to their own wives, anyone else. But Martucci would make the comment, boys, we just made history.
Compelling.
So all the more reason that they came to realize that they had flown out something extraordinary, something related to all the talk. And they all were aware of the talk of the crash, the flying saucer, the little people that were recovered from the crash site, and they just happened to be, as Martucci said, part of history. And we emphasize this was the day after the weather balloon explanation.
Yeah, we're going to get to a brigadier general talking about the weather balloon story in just a moment, but I just want to point out that Roswell was a very significant place before the crash, 2 years before. 1945, we blew up the first atomic bomb, which could be very well argued that that was a bit of a beacon to any extra-dimensional or extraterrestrial species in the neighborhood.
It's one of our theories, yes.
Okay, there you go. And that's where I heard it. And even before that, remember that Wernher von Braun, the Nazi scientist, was sending up rockets in Roswell, New Mexico. It was almost like the first international space station.
Well, there was... Robert Goddard used to send up rockets from Roswell. Wernher von Braun and the rest of the paperclip Germans that they brought over after World War II to start up our rocket program, they were over at White Sands, actually, Rob, and they were housed at the Fort Bliss at El Paso, Texas. But they were all brought over in 1946. And then in 1950, they moved to Huntsville, Alabama, and the rocket program continued there. But in New Mexico at the time, things were really going on. You had Los Alamos, where atomic research and helped develop the first atomic bomb. You had the Sandia weapons base, White Sands, the Trinity site where the first atomic bomb, as you said, was detonated in 1945. And I know I'm leaving out a site or two, but...
Well, Roswell, yes.
And oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Roswell. Roswell, at the time, was the only atomic strike force in the world. The Russians had hadn't yet detonated their first atomic device. That was going to happen in 1949. But Roswell, the 509th Bomb Group, was the first SAC base, Strategic Air Command base, to be started.
Yeah.
And soon, you know, it's that, like that Jimmy Stewart movie, Strategic Air Command. Well, it's all started at Roswell.
Yeah. From a galactic standpoint, it was kind of the center of our universe.
Yes.
Well, let's take a listen to Brigadier General Thomas DuBose, who talks about, as you just mentioned, the cover story of a balloon crashing. And this is someone who speaks with a lot of gravitas.
There's no doubt in your mind, I gather, that the balloon story was a cover story.
Absolutely none. We knew that it was a cover story. And whose idea it was, I don't have the faintest idea. But we used that in order to persuade the curiosity of the press, because this had gotten out, and see, all this created a lot of hubbub, and the president, somebody along the line, is going to say, who's running this show? And it comes up to the 8th Air Force, Rainey and or Chief of Staff, somebody in there, Captain or something.
There it is, in the own words of the Chief of Staff, General Rainey.
And Rainey was Colonel Blanchard's boss, the base commander over in Roswell. And as we were talking earlier, Rainey had the infamous weather balloon press conference. His chief of staff, DuBose, has even posed in two of the pictures with his boss with the substituted weather balloon. And there it is. I mean, DuBose stated, you know, quite frankly, that the balloon part of it was a hoax, that they were the ones who substituted the balloon material for the actual wreckage that was flown in with Major Jesse Marcel. Now, one of the things that DuBose also described to us was it was a 4th of July weekend when the rancher originally reported the find. Rainey was unavailable. When Blanchard, the base commander at Roswell, reporting it to his boss, contacts the 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, who they in turn contact immediately the Pentagon. They contact Washington. This is the evening, late afternoon of July 6th. Now, DuBose goes on to describe how he receives a personal phone call from the Pentagon from General Clements McMullen, ordering that the material brought in by the rancher be immediately flown to Washington. Now, the press release announcing to the world the recovery of the flying saucer would not come out for two more days. It came out around noon Central Standard Time on Tuesday, July 8th. So for anyone who still believes that this was a knee-jerk reaction on the part of Roswell, that they just overreacted to a silly conventional weather balloon, Washington already had the material in hand almost 2 days before, all demonstrating that this was orchestrated, that Washington was calling the shots, instructing Roswell how to handle this, and DuBose himself describing how the balloon was in many ways intended to get the press off of his boss, General Rainey's back.
Well, you mentioned Washington, and this sets up the next clip really well. It's Robert Smith, who was in the 390 Air Service Squadron and part of the crew that loaded some of the crates on a C-54. Tell us about his story and how it relates to President Truman.
Well, Bob Smith, the late Robert Smith, was part of the first air transport unit, the Green Hornets. Basically, the airlines of the Air Force, and he was involved in packaging up the making the crates and packaging up the wreckage into the crates. And what's interesting is that he told the story of one of the suits. He noticed a lot of suits, as they called them. These are FBI types, you know, to, for want of a better term, FBI types all of a sudden on the base. And he recognized one of them as a relative of his, a, I don't know, something like a cousin-in-law, you know what I mean? Not a very close relative, but certainly close enough that he recognized them. And neither one spoke to each other at the time. And it wasn't until years later at a family get-together that they met again. And Robert Smith, Bob Smith brought up the subject. And I don't recall, Don, did the suit, his cousin-in-law, did he ever come clean, or did he just give short answers again to make the thing go away?
Very dismissive, but he was a Secret Service agent. In fact, it's been confirmed that he indeed did serve with the Truman administration at that time, and that he served at the bequest of the president as an emissary to oversee the operation in Roswell. So in other words, he would report directly back to the president. And
he might have been the gentleman that Edwin Easley encountered, who told him to, that the president said to keep quiet.
And, in fact, Tom and I have a copy of a letter from the Secret Service thanking Edwin Easley for his cooperation in some specific incident that had happened that summer of July of 1947.
Let's listen to Robert Smith, Sergeant Smith, member of the 390 Air Service Squadron, tell it in his own words.
My involvement was to help load the crates of the debris onto the aircraft.
Did you see what they were creating of?
All I saw was a little piece of material, about so big square. And you could crumple it up, let it out, and it would come out flat. He could not crease it. One of the guys that was in on the crating and so forth, he picked up a piece, slipped it in his pocket. And where he is now, I don't know. Now, when I spoke with you on the phone, I mentioned about a distant cousin of mine that was with the Secret Service. And we talked it later. And I asked him, I said, where would they take something like that? I said, he said, well, he says, most likely Los Alamos. All of our secret stuff goes to Los Alamos.
He didn't have any firsthand knowledge of this event, though.
He was there.
At Roswell?
Yes. He came as more or less a representative of President Truman.
Did you see him at Roswell?
He saw me.
Did you discuss the specifics about what went on at Roswell with him in 72?
Well, some things. In other words, he asked what outfit I was with, and I told him, I said, first ATU. He says, oh, you guys blew it out. Backyard gossip with the UFO or something of that sort. He kind of grinned. He said, yeah.
It's hard to dismiss that, isn't it?
Well, it's first-hand testimony, and Robert Smith, I think Don will agree with me on this, is one of the key witnesses that we have ever uncovered in this case. There are a handful of witnesses that sort of corroborate the activities that we suspected went on, but they were actually involved in. And the other one was Bill Rickett. Bill Rickett was an NCO. He was another key witness. We have a handful of key witnesses that really say a lot as far as tying a number of things together. And in this case, Bob Smith is bringing in the President of the United States via his adjutant.
Yeah.
And as you remember earlier, we talked about Edwin Easley on his deathbed apologizing to his family, claiming that it was the president who had asked them to keep their mouths shut, never to say a word about the incident.
Seems as though we have more than a trail of breadcrumbs. Talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, their website is linked up right now at Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, your phone calls. I want to hear your ideas, your thoughts on this extraordinary expose on what happened so many years ago in the desert that's still shaping the course of America. You're on Coast to Coast AM.